Welcome to another episode of Future Library. Regular listeners may be able to tell that I've got a bit of a cold. I don't know, my voice sounds the same as ever to me in my head, but it might sound different to people listening. Or it might sound the same and people might be going, what are you talking about, Alex? But yeah, I've got, you know, in typical man fashion, I'm describing it as death flu. But really, it's a cold, isn't it? Let's be fair. It's just a cold. And I'll get over it. Anyway, enough of me blabbering on about my head cold. I have a guest. As I've said before with other episodes, what kind of show would it be without a guest? It wouldn't be a very good show. Well, it might. Well, you know, it'd be a different show. But my guest tonight is a songwriter from the US. I have played a gig with him many, many years ago, and we'll talk about that shortly. He used to perform under the name Cassio Tone for the Painfully Alone, has now become Advanced Bass, and his name is Owen Ashworth. How are you doing, Owen?
Hi, how are you? I know how you are. You have a cold.
I have
heard
a cold,
you talk about
yes.
It. I have a question about something you said, actually.
Oh, go on.
You mentioned in typical man fashion, you're calling this a death flu. In my travels in England, I've probably heard 5 or 6 times British people mention that men typically get affected by colds and flus much more so than women. Is this like a common sort of, not maybe not cliche, but sort of like, is this like a, you know,
it is.
Common theory?
Yeah, well, I think
interesting, because I've never heard that in the U.S., but it seems to be, I don't know if there's a different quality to illness in England, or if it's just the way people experience the illness.
Well, I'll let you into a little secret of what it actually is, Owen. It's not that the flu is any worse for men. It's that just men moan more. In the UK, whereas women can just go, oh, I've got a bit of a cold. Men will go, oh, I'm totally dying. So it becomes the kind of the whole idea that we are somehow more prone to getting messed up by colds, when I don't think we are. I think we just complain about it more. So,
okay.
Yeah, it gives the impression that maybe we're kind of more prone to, you know, there's something genetic going on and that we're, you know, the cold will affect the man far worse than it will affect the woman. But I think it's just because men in the UK moan a lot about getting sick. So, but yeah, I can see how from the outside it gives the impression that maybe we're, I don't know, prone to getting bad colds.
Yeah, I've always been curious about that. I got really sick, actually, on a UK tour, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago. But I was just, you know, deathly ill for a good week traveling through the UK. And I was traveling with 2 American friends who were both women who were not sick. And, you know, almost every night someone would make jokes about how, of course, I was the sick one. And, you know, they probably had it just as bad. They just weren't complaining.
It seems to be a kind of a semi regular thing. I hear stories of American touring acts getting sick. And there's the famous instance of Barr getting sick in, I think, in Northampton on tour and writing the song, or talking about it in the song. The song is the single. And it's, you know.
Oh, yeah, Brendan, the artist Barr. I thought you meant an entire bar. Like someone played at a bar and the entire bar got sick that night.
No,
that makes more sense.
Yeah,
I know Brendan. Yeah.
Yeah, Brendan got sick. And yeah, he wrote the song in the travel lodge. And the travel lodges are just horrible. So I felt very, very much for him, the idea of being ill in a travel lodge.
I had that very experience. I think Brendan and I have talked about this, but yeah, on that tour, we stayed at a lot of travel lodges because I felt like I was too sick to stay in anyone's house for the most part. So I was a lot of just like shivering night sweats in travel lodges.
You see, I didn't used to mind travel lodges particularly. I went through a lot of years of thinking travel lodges were basically okay because they were kind of fairly austere, but they were at least comfortable. Mm-hmm. But in recent years, they've all been kind of refitted in the UK, and now they're just horrendous. They are the most uncomfortable, unwelcoming spaces imaginable. And
yeah, when I come to the UK for a tour, I enjoy the first night in a travel lodge, just kind of for nostalgia and old time's sake, but yeah, you know, more than one night spent in the travel lodge is my morale plummets generally.
I kind of have a theory that staying in a travelodge for more than 3 nights starts to let you know what it feels like to be dead. That's my theory.
Was it the travelodge that Alan Partridge stayed at in his series, or was it an off-brand?
It was a mock version. It was a travel tavern he stayed in.
Travel tavern. Okay.
Yeah, I think it was very much intended to be a travel lodge. He stayed in a travel tavern, or as Chris Morris described it, how to describe it in the episode with the farmers. He said something about how he alienated everybody he met, and that's why he was sleeping in a ditch. And he goes, "It's not a ditch, it's a travel tavern." And he said, "Oh, look, I don't care what you call your sordid little grief hole." And it's like, yeah. So it does feel a little bit like that. You stayed at my flat in Dundee 10 years ago.
That's right, I remember. Yeah, that was the first time I came to Europe at all, my first tour overseas. And it was 3 months, and I remember I was in the UK for a heat wave. I don't think it was too bad in Scotland, but like traveling through England, like everyone was sort of complaining and apologizing to me for the weather. But I guess it's mostly, I mean, it didn't seem terribly hot to me from where I came from, but except that the fact there's no air conditioning anywhere, which was a big difference in what.
No, I remember it was 2003, wasn't it? I remember that was quite a hot summer. And it was hot in Scotland as well. I remember going over one day, going out with Dominic, who you met at the time, who was playing in the Moths with me back then. We went over the bridge. We went kind of for a walk one day over the bridge and right round to the beaches on the other side. It was a really long walk, and we realised halfway round that we hadn't taken any water or anything with us, which is kind of stupid.
Oh, yeah.
And then got very, very thirsty because it was very, very hot, and then we were very, very pleased to find a pub that was open. But yeah, I remember it being quite warm, and I remember you played at the Art Bar, which was a tiny little place in Dundee. And me and Dominic played as well. And that was, you actually played the, it was the last time the duo version of the Moths ever played together, that show. So it was a kind of.
What happened after that?
Well, Dominic went back to Canada. And then, because she was only visiting at the time. And you know,
that's right. Yeah.
So she went back to Canada. And then we kind of split up a few months later as a couple, and then you know that kind of meant that it split up as the band as well. But I kept on going on my own then for a long time, and then after a while got fed up of doing it, which is kind of interesting because I was reading one of your interviews, and it kind of ties in to I was reading about why you kind of brought Cassiotone to an end, and it tied in a bit. Because obviously you've gone from being, a lot of people have known you for Cassiotone for the Painfully Alone, and now, you know, doing the advanced bass thing. And I thought it was quite interesting the reason you'd said so. I'll let you explain that. I mean, what kind of led you to decide that Cassiotone has reached its natural end?
Yeah, it's a lot of things. I kind of just felt like the universe was telling me to do it. For a few years, I felt... I'm going to start over.
Okay.
Let me think. How do I want to talk about this? I think for a long... I did Cassiotone for 13 years, and for most of that time, I felt very aware that it was, you know, it was a project that would have its lifespan, and then it would be time to end. And I felt like I was often kind of preoccupied with what the end was going to be and what it was going to mean. And the last Cassiotone album is called Versus Children, and it was a record that I've been thinking about and sort of like slowly writing for 5 or 6 years, and kind of always knew that that was going to be the last Cassiotone record. And, you know, I recorded, you know, some other things sort of in between before I worked out that last record. And then I toured that last record for as long as it seemed responsible for, out of respect for my label and for, you know, wanting to get everything out of the project and doing everything I wanted to do. Like, I did tours with full bands, and I kind of felt like I'd realized those songs in every way that I wanted to. And, you know, lots of different arrangements and things like that. And, you know, getting to play with and tour with bands that I really wanted to play and tour with. But by the end, I was really done, and it, it just felt like a play coming to an end, and I was like, I am really burnt out on these songs, and I just felt like it's kind of taken its toll on my health just from all the touring, and I really damaged my hearing over the years. I mean, Cassiotone was mostly electronic, and it was some really loud and pretty harsh frequencies, and it just made the experience of performing really unpleasant after a while, and I had some kind of really intense psychosomatic reactions to things where just certain frequencies would just, I'd get angry, and I just, it was just, you know, it really hurt playing shows, and I just didn't want to do it anymore. And I had ideas for other music and things I wanted to do, but at the time that I stopped Cassiotone, I was really resolute, like, I'm done with these songs, it's time to start over and just, you know, figure something else out. So Advanced Bass was my idea for the next project, and it started with the idea that it would be mostly, I wanted to play mostly with like live instruments as opposed to electronics, and make something a little gentler and not quite as hard on my ears. But you know, over the last few years, my ears have gotten a lot better, and I don't have, you know, the pain that I did for a long time. And Advanced Space did start as a band, but just out of necessity and over time, it has sort of dropped back to just being me for the most part. I have other people that I'll occasionally play with live or record with, but it's mostly just me again. And I've started playing some Cassiotone songs again occasionally, because after a few years, I started to miss them, and it feels nice to play them and not hate them.
I can absolutely relate.
Yeah.
I mean, I stopped doing the Moths after about a similar amount of time, because I'd started it in around 2000 and stopped maybe 2 or 3 years ago now. And I think for me, it was just, I was reaching the point where it almost felt like it was this kind of ever-growing weight around my legs. And,
yeah,
you know, every time,
yeah,
and even to the point where seeing the name written down started to kind of make me just feel slightly sick. It's just like, you know, and because I'd made so much music doing it, and it had changed so much over the years, that I started to think, it just felt like each one just became just another thing that I was doing. And I started to not, again, like you're saying, I started to not want to play shows and things like that. But then weirdly, in the same way as you're saying about starting to play some Cassiotone shows again, or Cassiotone songs, I should say, I actually, after a couple of years of not doing it, played an acoustic The Moth show, which was probably the first time I'd played acoustically in like 5 years. And that's kind of nice. It's nice to be able to break the songs out when you don't have to, I think. You know, and I don't know, is that what you found, that, you know, having the pressure off means you can appreciate playing them again when you want to without feeling that you have to?
Absolutely, yeah. And, yeah, I mean, Cassiotone, I started when I was 20, and people would request songs that I wrote when I was 20, when I felt not a whole lot of connection to, you know, something I'd written a dozen years before, mm-hmm. and I kind of felt like phony and kind of just going through the motions after a while. But at this point, I can kind of pick and choose, and if there are some songs that I just really enjoy playing now, or I have a very different relationship with them, you know, I have a lot of distance between what was going on when I wrote them, but if there are songs that are my songs, and if they still feel good to play, then, you know, when I feel like it, I will play them, and it's very satisfying. It's nice now.
Yeah. I have to say, from the bits of Advanced Bass I've listened to, the sounds are certainly more kind of rounded, and you're absolutely right, sort of softer sounding. Is it the Fender Rhodes that you're using now? So you've got the kind of...
Yeah, that's the instrument that I've written all the songs on, and mm-hmm. it's kind of like the bass. Or, you know, sort of the foundation of you know, the arrangements. But, you know, I was recording with AutoHarp a lot. I haven't been playing shows with AutoHarp much because they are an enormous pain to tune. Yeah. And when I was playing with a full band, we would, you know, be flipping coins to see who had to tune the AutoHarp that night. We were so sick of it. But it sounds great for recording, but it is just, it's a beast to travel around with. So... it's mostly just Rhodes, but, you know, I have piano and sort of some other instruments fleshing out a lot of the recordings.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned the auto harp because I was listening to summer music just before I called you. And did I hear an omnichord at the end of that? Or is that?
Yes, there's a bit of omnichord on the album, and I've recorded with that as well. And that's a lot of fun. It's just one of those instruments that it doesn't take a lot to play, and every once in a while, just like a splash of that instrument, it just sounds really like sparkly and magical, but there's like zero skill to playing that thing, but it's kind of like a nice secret weapon to have. I try not to rely on it too much, because I feel like it kind of always starts to sound the same on too many songs, but it can be a nice sort of accent.
Yeah, I actually had one for a little while, and I'd really like to get another. The reason I had it, and I loved my omnichord, but I had to sell it because at the time, my wife and I were quite kind of skint, so we were having to look at things we were willing to let go. But yeah, I do miss my omnichord, because there is something about them that you just pick them up and they almost play themselves for you, don't they? You just put your hands down and something musical comes out straight away. I have found, though, and it's something that I can't understand why more people haven't done it. I've started to play around with things on my iPhone and my iPad, and I have found a couple of apps that are actually quite kind of similar to the omnichord in a way. But you'd think with touchscreen instruments, it would be the perfect thing to emulate, but you know, I don't know why there aren't many.
I've been kind of surprised there isn't just a straight up omnichord, you know, replicator. Yeah. I mean, there are a couple. I found an app that was similar. And I have a 2-year-old daughter, and I bought this music app that kind of works similarly as an omnichord that she really enjoys playing with. But, you know, it's not quite the same thing, but it seems like Suzuki should really get their act together and just make, like, a fake omnichord app.
Yeah.
I'm sure people would go crazy for it.
There was quite a good Max MSP emulation of it on OS 10 on the Mac a while ago, but it stopped working when it went to when it stopped being Tiger, so it stopped working quite a long time ago. But yeah, the one I've got here, let me think, what's this one called? Auto Harp, is that the one you've got?
The app I have?
Yeah.
I actually honestly don't remember what it was called. We got a secondhand iPad from my mom, and just because my daughter got obsessed with her grandma's iPad, my mom was nice enough to hand one down. And I have used it very little, but my daughter is like a total whiz with that thing, where she can put on her Curious George cartoons or, you know, draw pictures. Or there's like a kaleidoscope app that she's really obsessed with that's really beautiful. But I never feel so old as when I watch my daughter, you know, navigate a piece of machinery that I don't have the first clue about. But yeah, I downloaded that. I don't use a lot of computer stuff for my own music, but it's been kind of fun. I put a few apps on that for her to play with, and one was like a vintage drum machine simulator, which has a lot of pads and a lot of sounds from, like, you know, old, like 808s and Rhythm Kings and things like that. And she makes a real racket with that, and it's been really fun to watch her, you know, nice. Just respond to sound and, you know, respond to music.
Well, I've got this actually loaded here, and I'm going to play a chord on it and see how it sounds and see what we think.
Okay.
So, well, that was very silent. I think I need to turn the volume up. Yeah, that would work. that's what happens with live podcasting, listeners. Occasionally that kind of thing happens. So hopefully this won't be too loud. That's not too bad, is it?
That's nice, yeah.
That's quite a Casio tone chord sequence, that. So C, A minor, E minor 7th, and D minor 7th.
Nice.
Yeah, so it's not bad.
Yep.
But yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think Suzuki are missing a trick there. They should just release a straight emulation for touch devices, and they'd have.
I know a bunch of bands who would download that thing in a heartbeat. Yeah.
Yeah, because, you know, I did love the actual omnichord, but there's, you know, I think from a kind of practical point of view, being able to have one on your phone that sounds exactly like it would be brilliant.
But we can't release this podcast, you realize, because we need to go right to the patent office and get this taken care of.
Well, we've got until the beginning of January to do that. Which actually made me think of something else, that because of some of the podcasts I'm recording quite a long way ahead of when they come out, what happens if some event happens? And then
If I die in the next couple of weeks?
Well, I wasn't thinking of something quite that dramatic. Well, dramatic, but not directly involving either of us. I mean, if you died in the next couple of weeks, which, you know, God forbid that happened, then I'd release it as a tribute podcast. And I'd change the music at the beginning to minor key music.
Perfect.
You know, but it's like, you know, what if there's like some global catastrophe at some point, and then we're not talking about it? Yeah.
World War IV.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? People will figure it out. People are smart. They know how time works. It'll be all right.
Well, I figured a solution to this. We could just say, oh, and that thing that happened. Man, that thing that either happened or didn't happen. Wasn't that either amazing, awful, or non-existent? Whoa.
You could. I have a Bill Withers live record where as he's starting a song, it's a really good song called I Can't Write Left-Handed, and he has this little preamble on the record from the show talking about Vietnam War, but by the time the record came out, Vietnam War was over, and so as the band is sort of kicking into the song, Bill Withers, like in the recording studio afterwards, like comes on mic and he's like, "We recorded this before Vietnam War ended," and so I always thought that was really interesting. It's like there must have been like a panic at the studio at the time they're finishing the record. They're like, "The war's over. What about our anti-war song?" And he's like, "Give me the mic. I got something." But it's just like this very short, you know, just this blah. There's not a war anymore. This is from before that moment. That I don't know. It's such an interesting, like, kind of cultural document.
Well, what I'll do if a war happens, I'll drop in my voice over this point saying, "We recorded this before the war started."
Or I'll
have a whole load recorded ready for it, and it'll be like, you know, we recorded this before the zombie invasion happened, or of course we recorded this before the singularity happened, or we recorded.
I guarantee
this.
You, if there is a zombie invasion, we don't have to worry about whether people are going to be confused by this podcast. No one's going to listen to it.
You know what?
There'll be zombies.
I'm optimistic. I think zombies still want to know about keyboard based pop.
All right.
You know, I think
flattering to think about.
Even zombies, you know, if we've learned nothing from The Walking Dead, Zombieland, I was actually going to rattle off a whole load of zombie things there to the point of exhaustion, but then I couldn't think of any more, which is quite embarrassing, really. I could have thought I'll start with Walking Dead and Zombieland, and if I can keep going for maybe a minute, that could be quite funny. But then I ran out of them very fast. But if lots and lots of zombie things have taught us anything, it's that, you know, zombies need love too. All they want to do is eat and shamble. And in some cases, run. You know, and we have to allow for that. And obviously, they're going to need to listen to music, which neatly brings me back to Advanced Space. So you've got an album that has happened.
Yeah, there's one Advanced Space album. It's called The Shut-In's Prayer. It came out like a year and a half ago, I've released some like EPs and like singles and things since then, but it's the one album. I like it. I'm pretty proud of it. A Shut-In's Prayer, available in the UK on Tom Lab Records and available in North America on Arindel Records, which is my label.
Nice. And Tom Lab, I believe, the former home maybe of The Books, wasn't it?
The Books and who else? Parenthetical Girls.
Yeah.
And Cassiotone. They did all the Cassiotone albums. No Kid, the great No Kids from Vancouver, British Columbia. And, a bunch of bands.
And the fantastic Alphabet series that they did of all those 7 inches.
Oh, yeah. I've been trying to get in touch with, do you know Bobby Kahn by any chance?
I know the name, but I don't know him personally.
He lives in Chicago. I have his copy of the Alphabet series box set. Tom sent it to me. He's like, "Could you please give this to Bobby Kahn?" Because he couldn't get Bobby Kahn's address. And I keep meaning to find out how I can get in touch with Bobby Kahn.
Well,
Bobby Kahn, if you know Bobby Kahn and you're listening to this,
We may be lucky.
Send me an email.
Yeah, we may be lucky. Because, well, recently the podcast has actually picked up a whole load of new listeners. I've got the stats from the guy who hosts it for its first week before it goes up on iTunes, and was stunned to see that we're up into four figures of listenership for each one. So it's helped that we've had recently people like Throwing Muses on, and big names from the UK as well. So I kind of like the way I'm doing it now is I'm kind of trying to mix it up with kind of as high a profile people as I can find, kind of, you know. So I think kind of people sort of your level and up, I think I'm looking for is the kind of high profile people, then kind of mid-range people, and then I'm every few episodes throwing in somebody that nobody's ever heard of, and I'm kind of hoping that that has the effect of pulling the nobody ever heard of people up and letting lots of people. And I'm kind of hoping that with the way that the show is put together and kind of is kind of quite conversational, and you know, I'm hoping that people are kind of liking the style of it. As I say, almost every episode, I reveal something a little bit about what's going on behind the scenes. So there you go, listeners. That's this week's Look Behind the Curtain.
Numbers are up.
Yeah, so it tells people what's going on. So yeah, so it's been such a long time. I remember my main memories of playing with you in Dundee was how heavy your keyboard bag was.
It was really dumb. I dragged two big suitcases full of Casios across Europe on trains, and then on the National Express bus across the UK for the hottest summer on record. I grew a lot as a person that summer. I feel like it was a real good personal challenge kind of experience, but I would not do that again. It's pretty rough.
And the other thing is, I remember, is it's something that I feel I need to apologize about, was that we got back to the flat after meeting you at the bus station. And I remember you went to use the bathroom, and after you'd gone to use the bathroom, I remember turning to Dominic and saying, did we tell him about the broken toilet seat? And she was like, I don't think we did. And I remember you coming out and going, I think I broke your toilet. And it's like, no, you didn't. It's like, but I kind of felt so bad that we hadn't pre-warned you, because we got so used to pre-warning people saying, by the way, the toilet seat's broken, so that people wouldn't come out and go, I think I've broken your toilet. And then the one person that we didn't do it with was yourself. And so I do apologize.
I have some great news.
Go on.
I don't remember that at all.
Oh, that's good then, because you did look kind of uncomfortable when you came out. I can imagine how it would feel if you could have came, you know, if I was visiting somebody's house and I thought I'd broken something, I'd be like, oh God.
I got to say, after 3 months on borrowed toilets, there's a lot of humility and dignity that compromised.
But see,
it was a wash of embarrassing toilet experiences. You know, I had months and months of those kind of, you know, at least we spoke the same language, because trying to beg for a toilet in Paris is a totally different matter.
And you see, this is the kind of chat you don't get in any other podcast, listeners. So this is the kind of thing that I imagine it being cited in Wikipedia at some point or something like that.
Is this specifically a toilet podcast? I didn't read the rundown.
It's called Future Library About Toilets. I have had one recently where I was talking to Lachlan Rattray, who's a musician from Glasgow, and we spent an inordinate amount of time talking about working in old people's homes all the unpleasantries that go with that. So it does have a kind of way of going in directions that sometimes aren't pleasant. Then we can
a laboratory or bent.
Yes, but let's wrench it back. When I was watching the video for Summer Music, I noticed the kind of editing of film thing, and I kind of thought that was quite a neat kind of tie-in to your own kind of film school background. And I remember you saying making the music that was filmic music, that almost presenting little scenes but in songs.
Yeah, I should say that I had almost nothing to do with that music video. I'm very pleased with how it turned out, but a guy named Philip Hodges, who works at Jim Henson Studios, put that together, and I was very excited about the prospect of there being a Muppet in one of my music videos. But I did have very little to do with the actual details of what ended up being in that video. But yeah, it was a nice. I mean, definitely, you know, in my you know, I hate saying wheelhouse. I hate saying up my alley. But I think English people say up your street or up my street. Is that the English version of up your alley?
Yeah.
And that sounds less creepy to me. So I'm going to say, yeah, it's nice to see that there's some movie stuff in that video, because that's definitely something I'm interested in. I went to film school and I dropped out of it because I realized film was stupidly expensive and it required working with other people, which I didn't want to do. So I started writing and just making music just as more of a creative outlet. But yeah, I remain like a real big fan of movies, but I was personally defeated by the medium of filmmaking. I do not have what it takes to make movies. So I am a fan, and that's fine.
But you do have what it takes to tell stories, which
I was hoping you'd say that.
Yeah. It's one of the things I think that's been, you know, a common theme across, pretty much everything I've ever heard by you over the years has been that they're like these little vignettes of people's lives, these like little sort of slices of what's going on, and they're always very kind of evocative. And I think you're a very good storyteller, and you're very good at doing it in a very kind of minimal way. And I think that's a strength, because your lyrics are always they always seem very effortless.
Oh, that's nice to hear. That's not true at all. So that's great. There are definitely a lot more words that, you know, end up not making it into the song. But yeah, I really bang my head against the table trying to get some of those songs right. And it sometimes takes years before I decide a song is finished. Or, you know, but I'm doing something right if it doesn't sound like they're too labored over.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you are doing something right, because they're obviously very, very crafted, because they're so cleverly put together. But they sort of flow really kind of nicely, and they kind of flow in a way that when I'm speaking for myself, when I'm listening to them, each next part you kind of go, yeah, that does seem where that should go. And you can't really imagine it having gone anywhere other than where it's gone. And I think that's, to my mind, a kind of a strength in a songwriter, making it sound like it's the most obvious thing that it could ever have been. And that is the thing that it always should have been, that song, whichever one it is.
Thanks. That's a big compliment. Thank you.
Well, I think, you know, I think credit where credit's due. I think you've... I think the way you present the songs as well, I think there's a, it's kind of almost kind of classic American songwriter kind of thing, which is, you know, I can imagine if you'd been around in the 60s and 70s, you know, I don't know, maybe you'd have been in a band like the Eagles or something, but you'd be on the front cover of Mojo and stuff as being one of the great American voices.
I'm pretty convinced that if I had made music in the 60s, none of us would have ever heard it, because I wouldn't have been able to afford recording equipment, and absolutely nobody would have given me a record deal. I feel like it is thanks to the home recording movement and a lowering of certain standards and the advent of punk ethics that have allowed me to have any kind of, you know, recording career. Because I certainly don't have the kind of voice that anyone would want to give her a record deal to, and I'm not a very good musician, if we're going to be totally honest. I think that writing songs is the best thing I got going for me, but I think that it's thanks to kind of, you know, the bedroom pop movement that I have any kind of forum whatsoever for making music. You know, I think I'm better now than I was when I started out, but. You know, if I had shot my demo tape, as a 20-year-old man, shopped my demo tape around in 1962, I would have been encouraged to finish college.
I think that's true of a lot of people, though, that are now making music. I think a lot of things that we now accept as being completely normal would have been seen as being utterly peculiar 30, 40 years ago. And I think that's actually a good thing that we've reached that point where everything is kind of okay. It's all right to do anything. And people certainly seem to be more open to hearing more unusual sounds.
I think that's exciting. I feel like nowadays you are granted a much more, I don't know what the word I'm looking for is. I mean, you get much more of a sense of what someone is really like as a person. I feel like this curtain has been removed, as far as like a lot of artistic endeavor. And I think there's a lot more vulnerability and humanity to what people are allowed to present. And, you know, these days, that makes sense.
Absolutely.
I feel like you get a really unfiltered view of someone's problems.
And I think it also helps that there's, you know, the way that social media has taken off, that people are within reach. I mean, the example is I spent my kind of late teenage years and most of my 20s being obsessed with the Throwing Muses. And the thought of then having been sitting speaking to Kristen and Dave, you know, on a Skype connection, would have blown my mind, and I'd have just been like, oh, I'm going to shit my pants with excitement. And yeah, because you can then tweet people and they will respond, and then you have conversations with people. They suddenly become just people, and then you can talk to them. And I think that's good in some ways. And I think it's maybe I think with super famous people, I think it can be maybe a bit risky for them, because they'll obviously, with a larger fan base, there's a much greater risk of having psychopaths amongst that fan base. But I think at the level that, you know, that we're dealing with, I think there's less chance of that. And it's nice to be able to kind of have that personal contact with people that maybe 20, 30 years ago, all they would have ever remained would have been names in magazines and on record sleeves.
Yeah.
And I think it's really positive, you know?
I am amazed that I've had such positive experiences for the most part with social media. I feel like I hear so many horror stories of people just getting these terrible messages and getting, you know, heckled and things like that. And for the most part, people are really nice to me, and I am relieved and very grateful for that. I was going to say something about Kristen Hirsch. I just found out recently that she babysat a really good friend of mine when my friend was really small. My friend Marina grew up in Providence, Rhode Island. Her dad was a rock journalist and was friends with Kristen. And for years, she was their babysitter. And I think that is the sweetest thing. And it made me love her music even more to know that she was a really good babysitter to my friend.
I think things like that are nice, aren't they? That you find out that there's that kind of humanity behind people. And I think that's what social media has been great for, is revealing the person behind various, you know, acts. Because I mean, for everybody who's like yourself, who kind of writes these kind of very, very clear songs about kind of relationships and occurrences in people's lives, there's some people that kind of are quite obscure with what they write. And I think having that opportunity to contact and have the contact of just a human being helps with that. And I kind of think it's a great kind of I'm wanting to avoid the word leveler, because it sort of has negative context sometimes, but I think, you know, reminding everybody that we're all human beings, I think, is a really positive thing. I think that's what I'm trying to get at.
Yeah.
You know, and I think there's no harm in that. And it's, and the internet has been fantastic. It's actually interesting. My wife and I, Kat, we were talking about what happened was, we were talking today about the fact that I had this awful realization today that the Second World War was closer in years to my birth than I am from my birth now. because I'm going to be 41 this year.
Yeah.
And I was kind of like, had that this horrible kind of moment of like, oh my God, I'm getting really old. And we were talking about how the 90s still seem really recent to us. I still think of the 90s as 10 years ago.
Yeah, I kind of do too. I'm 36, but I have, very vivid recollections of, pop culture in particular. But, it still weirds me out that dumb shit I wore as a teenager is, like, being worn ironically now.
Yeah. But then we got
young people who look like young people when I was young now.
Well, we got to the thing is, we then started thinking about, well, is there a reason why that decade seems so kind of fresh in our minds? And I think for anybody over 30, it seems to be that kind of touchstone decade for them. And I think it's because we came to the conclusion that it's because the two decades since, or the decade and a half since, I should say, hasn't seemed to have really any kind of definition to it. I mean, the first decade of the 21st century was obviously marked with, the whole thing was September the 11th, and then everything after that seemed to be coloured by that one event for the whole decade. And then we're only just coming out of the shadow of that whole mess around all that. But there seems to me that for maybe the last 13 years, there hasn't been any particular shape to culture. And we came to the conclusion that partly it's down to the internet, because the internet started to really pick up at the beginning of the century. And it's almost meant that all history exists simultaneously now to people, because they can get information from all decades and stuff. Like my children, my two sons, don't see anything different between music that was made 30 years ago and music that was made last week. They just see it as music. And I think that's something that maybe our generation didn't experience, because we were always having to kind of get things filtered through gatekeepers like the music press and friends and things like that for recommendations. And now things are just, everything's there. You read about something, you can go to the internet, type it in, and 2 seconds later you're listening to it. And I think, maybe that's maybe why the 90s stays so fresh in our minds, because maybe that was the last decade that had a shape.
I think that is also just sort of, we're close enough in age where I think that the 90s were just kind of a really significant formative time. Like, that was when we were teenagers. Mm-hmm. So I think every generation has, like, a particular fondness to, like, the era when they kind of, came into their own. I think that with time, I think we'll be able to recognize more distinctions of, like, what made the aughts different than the 90s or the aughts different than the teens. Like, I'm not sure I agree with that there hasn't been, like, a more, defining cultural signposts in, the last 13 years. I certainly think music has changed. I think that, everything is digital. And everything is just compressed like crazy, and everything is, if it is an autotune, there is just sort of like a computer kind of uniformity to so much recording, where you don't hear mistakes in popular music. But I think, like, when I listen to the radio, like, I can't believe this is music sometimes. I mean, it makes me feel like a totally old man. But, I think that, sort of, like, what is sort of acceptable in, like, the mainstream for, like, pop music certainly sounds different than it did in the 90s, where, I don't know, you'd at least hear some weird voice breaks or, some weird off notes occasionally in a 90s song.
But then I suppose on the other side of it, with kind of pop hits now, there are some very peculiar kind of sounds that would have been seen as kind of quite extreme in kind of left field electronica 10 years ago. And I think that's the only thing I can draw from it that I kind of see as a positive of a lot of kind of chart stuff, is that the producers certainly are sneaking an awful lot of stuff that would have been considered very avant-garde in. Like Will.i.am is chucking in sounds that are, because some of them are really quite out there, and you can listen to them, you go, yeah, you know what, that reminds me of, Venetian snares, or, that sounds like some kind of piece of J-pop I heard that was kind of crazy lo-fi stuff, and it's, but then are they just stealing it? That's the thing. Are they just kind of cultural magpies?
I think it's really exciting that so much of the weird, like, house and techno and like, dance music from, like, that sounded so bizarre to me. And, like, sort of context-free, when I was a teenager, like, hearing dance music, I was like, this is crazy. Like, who listens to dance music? And it's just, that is, like, that is just so, just the norm now. Like, mm-hmm. it has influenced so much music. And I don't know, it's kind of cool to see those things become, to go from being so weird to so normal. Yeah. That's something about hearing weird house music and rap music now is kind of exciting to me. I'm okay with that.
Yeah, actually, it's interesting you mentioned rap, because I think rap and hip-hop, certainly the backing tracks in that, have really kind of embraced avant-garde electronica sounds and a kind of sparseness. Yeah. And I think that's very exciting, the sounds that are coming out of that. But I kind of think that basically, if you want to know what's going to be the sounds of the pop charts in 10 years' time, you go and have a look at what's going on in the underground now, and those sounds will filter yeah. through. You look for the most extreme sounds in the underground now, and those will be the norm in 10 years' time, and the sounds in the underground will be even odder. But I think it's great. I think the whole kind of package of having all these things happen. But yeah, on the other hand, though, I do know what you mean. I feel like a very old man when I put the radio on, because I just put it on and I think, oh, this is just shit, and I switch it off.
Yeah.
But then I go and listen to something that else is current, which is something, you know, that I'll have got from somebody who's a friend or somebody who's recommended something from a Bandcamp page or something like that. I think what's stopping us turning into the old fuddy-duddies of the previous generations is that we're keeping up with what's current, but we're not keeping up with what's current in the mainstream, if that makes sense.
I see what you mean, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I find I listen to commercial radio pretty infrequently these days, but I really enjoy putting on just like the hip-hop station every couple weeks and just hearing what is right now, because I feel like the same songs get played so much that listening to too much of the radio just bums me out, because I'm hearing the same five songs over and over again, and I get too obsessed with payola and thinking about what these, you know, people must have shelled out to be on the radio this much. I just get obsessed with sort of like the politics and finances of radio. But it's really fun just to put every couple of weeks put on the radio and hear something crazy, because I feel like especially like hip hop stations, there's something so sensationalist about like the big hit singles, where you will hear something sonically insane, and you know, people will say crazy stuff, but you will just also just hear the most insane sounds, and that can be so exciting. It's like action movies. It's like listening to action movies through your radio.
Fantastic. I like that analogy. I think that's a really good one. It actually reminds me that I've got to chase up Dose One of Themselves and Subtle and Cloud Dead fame, because I did tweet him and ask him if he'd come on the podcast at some point, and he has said he will, so hopefully fingers crossed, because I've been a huge fan. I mean, listening to his stuff
is
always tremendously exciting, and again, he's somebody who reminds me a little bit of his. Go on.
Oh, I was just going to say, I played a show with him in Germany a few years ago, and after, you know, knowing his music and knowing, just hearing so much about him for so many years, it was a real treat to know that he's like just a really nice and good guy. Yeah. But it was a really, really pleasant experience meeting him. And I tell him I say hi.
If
he comes on. I really like that guy.
Yeah, I'm kind of like, I'm kind of quite excited about it, but I've kind of reached that age where I now don't allow myself to get too excited until something's actually happened. Until I've actually got the person on the other end of the line talking to me, then I can go, done it, yes.
Yeah.
So, you know, because otherwise you get disappointed if it doesn't happen. So, you know. Yeah.
Yes.
That's what I said. So, I should let you go fairly shortly. So, what happens if people want to find out about you? Where should they point their little pointy things on their screens?
Yes. Well, the name of my band is Advance Bass. That's E. Oh, sorry, I just heard my daughter crying. She's up from her nap. Advance Bass is spelled ADVANCEBASE. And if you add music and .com to that, that is the website for my songs. And I also run a little label called Arindel, where I've released all the advanced bass, and I also putting out some records for a woman named Julie Byrne, who makes really beautiful sort of psychedelic folk music, and for my brother Gordon, who makes really crazy American primitive and like tape drone music. The Orindal website is ORINDAL.com, and there's a lot of mail order for Casio Tone and Advanced Bass and other stuff there.
Well, I will put links to those in the descriptions for the podcast as well. So if any listeners want to find that information, as your daughter is up and about, I should let you go to look after familial matters. Owen, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you. I hope you get back to the UK.
Yeah, likewise.
I now have a spare room. So, you know, if you actually come to this part of the world, I now have a spare room with an ensuite bathroom you can stay in. So it's very fancy.
It's really nice. I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
You're more than welcome to come and stay at our house anytime. Well, it's been a pleasure. All that's left to say is thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening, listeners. And there'll be another podcast fairly soon. And Owen, thank you very much. And bye-bye. Future Library is brought to you by PetPiranha.com, where you can go and find out various things about people who we've talked about and various people who haven't been on the podcast yet, but might be in the future. If you want to follow us on Twitter, it's twitter.com/FutureLibrary1. So that's Future Library with a number one. And you can email me at alexbottom@gmail.com. And don't forget to subscribe via iTunes. Just search for Future Library there. That's it. Thanks.